You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is Walk the Talk with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. In these podcasts, I will be talking with people who share their stories of tragedy and hope. I will be exploring mental health and well-being with workplace professionals and also with folk who struggle to make sense of their own lives. My hope is that these shared experiences will remove the loneliness from those people who are convinced it is their fate to suffer alone. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been a police officer for over 20 years. You're very welcome to join me on Walk the Talk. Liam Martin, by his own admission, didn't enjoy school, and academically left with very little. He joined the army and worked hard to gain his Green Beret after completing the Royal Marines Commando course. After serving in Iraq, he left the army and joined the police, spending the next 13 years serving the people of Lancashire. But as we have heard so many times before, he attended several incidents that adversely affected his mental health, and he resigned. Searching for a purpose and perhaps trying to make sense of his own life, he by chance got into project management, which led him into the world of systems thinking. Today, he advises companies on their own structures and has found the purpose he was looking for all along. Liam explains how systems thinking is a way of looking at the world rather than describing a system that functions within an organisation. Using practical examples to explain sometimes complex theories, Liam gets us to think about the world we live in and how, maybe, we should just take a few minutes to think about problems and their solutions from a different angle and avoid the sometimes unattended consequences that inevitably follow. We also discuss the police service, well-being and mental health from a systems thinking perspective. Liam, welcome to Walk the Talk. I have to confess that I've never approached an interview knowing so little about the topic that we are going to discuss, and despite researching the subject matter, I'm still really none the wiser. But before we do, perhaps could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Straight out, I was a operational police officer. I'm now head of business transformation at a NHS company in Blackpool. But the story of Liam Martin. Started school as quite a quiet young lad. When I went to senior school, parents got divorced for all the right reasons, and a couple of bits that went on while I was at school, just school didn't work out for me particularly well. I found it very difficult. I found it very difficult to engage. It was just a very, very difficult time for me. Wasn't very successful at school. Left with GCSEs that could effectively have spelt fudge. And I would suggest that I left a really angry, lost and scared young man, to be honest. And at that point, I remember vividly, around the time, just before my GCSEs, I had a dream that I'd won the lottery. And I physically felt, in the dream, this weight of fear of being a complete failure drop off my shoulders in the dream and go, oh God, thank God for that. I've not got to face the life I'm now destined for because I've struggled so much at school. And then I woke up and that fear just dropped back on those shoulders with a vengeance. And it was almost as if it wasn't until that point I had realised that it was there. And it was a very vivid moment that stayed with me for 20 years now. So I left school really, really nervous. I'd had, both my mum and dad had been successful. All my friends had done much better than me at school. I felt real pressure to not be a failure. Wasn't a lot, in my opinion, I felt I could do, so I ended up joining the army. And when I joined the army, I was obviously joined as a non-commissioned officer, but I wanted to do something. I wanted to strive for something. I didn't want to be just in the army. I wanted to, not that there's anything wrong with just being in the army, but I wanted something to almost justify myself, and probably only justify myself to myself. So I saw a regiment called 29 Commando, which do the Marines Commando course, the Green Beret, and I thought, oh, I'm going to do that. And it was almost, I imagine it was, I could walk around with my shoulders back and my head held high if I have a Green Beret. So I went down that route. It was one of the hardest mental things I've ever done. It was definitely the most difficult physical thing I've ever done, but also one of the things I'm most proud of. I was in the army for about 4 years, served in Iraq during the conflict. And at some point, I realised, you know what, this is a fun job. I'm enjoying it, but it's not a job, it's a life. And I don't want it as a life. If I could come here and work 8 to 4 Monday to Friday, fantastic. And I was also starting to find it really, really mentally constraining. I don't really want to live in this command and control structure. I want to think a bit more openly. So I left the army and I moved on. Came out of the army and I did a couple of jobs. I did welding for about 10 weeks. Then I ended up doing a bit of financial advising and eventually ended up applying for Lancashire Police, which seemed like the natural progression from the military. I think many people have gone down that route. And moved to Lancashire. And did I just enter the police in like a bull in a china shop? I suppose I got wrapped up in this self-belief. I had somewhat would have been classified back then in terms of the target culture of being successful, being the top cop. Started to consider myself as almost super cop. I can solve anything. I kick doors down. I catch bad guys. I am super cop. And then about 4 years in, I went to a job as super cop, believing all my own hype. And I went to a job with a guy stood on a bridge. I got out of the car and I thought, I'm just going to talk this gentleman down. He turned, looked at me, and then just took a penguin dive off the motorway bridge headfirst in the middle lane of the M6. It was night time. It was snowing. I remember running up to the fence in. It was Junction 29. Remember it vividly. Looking over, seeing this guy flat in the middle of the motorway. And then I looked down the motorway and I just saw these headlights flying towards him. And the next sort of 5 minutes, I've got no memory of. And my brain essentially just shut down, protected itself. That sent me into a spiral of really quite poor mental health, which I didn't expect. I think it was a long way to fall from being super cop. It was, as we've literally just been talking about over a cup of tea, it was straw that broke the camel's back. There was lots of stuff I'd been carrying that sent me off. I came back with a relatively changed view on policing, but I soon fell back into the same routine of I got really good operationally, loads of success, and it became me again. And then I came across another problematic place in both home and work, and my world imploded. I never really had any stability inside and outside, and ended up in a second period of ill mental health. I went to some really dark places and I felt alone, I felt lost, and I felt trapped. I felt like I was mortgaged into a job that I just no longer felt mentally capable to do. I felt unhappy. I felt like no one cared about me. I didn't know where to go with my life. And it wasn't until I woke up one day, I remember vividly where I was. I was sat hunched over 3 o'clock in the morning, a computer in Chorley Police Station, and I had my stab vest on, my boots, and I just decided I don't want to do this anymore. And I was hunched over my computer going, oh my, how am I possibly going to go from being a bobby in a pair of boots to doing something else? How do I do that? It just felt, the journey just felt so huge. I just felt lost. Ended up moving into change systems thinking, found a bit of a passion, and then last year came across a really amazing company that I now work for, who I now work for as head of business transformation. I'm in a much better place as a result, but I draw it back to that moment when I just said, I'm either going to go left or right at this junction, which one's it going to be?
Well, it sounds to me, and I suppose I'm in a little bit of a similar situation, that perhaps childhood wasn't as good as it could have been, and those experiences do echo on through our adult lives, and it sounds though you're perhaps looking for a purpose, what with your service in the military and the police, and perhaps not finding it in those organisations.
Very, very much so. I think I'd gone beyond it being my purpose at work, it'd become me. When I first went off, I got given a book called Emotional Survival Guide for Law Enforcement Officers. It's an unbelievably good book, and I'd encourage anyone that's listening, that's Reece, don't wait for it to all go wrong. Read it the moment you join up. The moment you start getting giddy about the job, read this book. But the key message in that book is, when you talk about what you do, don't tell people you are a police officer. Tell people you work as a police officer. Make that first break. Separate you from job. Because you control you, but the organisation controls the job. Don't give everything you are to the hands of someone else. Keep it within your control. Make that break. My name is Liam Mann and I work as a police officer. It might seem simple, but it's the implications of making that separation are huge.
Well, that's a really interesting thing you say, because I suppose it brings into question whether being a police officer is a job or a vocation, which is a word we hear often, isn't it?
Very, very much so. It's, you're giving a lot of yourself to be a police officer. You are giving over some of your mental health, let's be honest, some of your well-being. You're giving up a lot of your free time. You're missing family weddings. You give a lot more to the job that you give to society, almost as a gift for the betterment of everyone in the UK. We all benefit from, as a result of, the gifts that our emergency services give, but it is very, very important that you are aware of that give and you don't give all of yourself.
Well, yeah, John Sutherland describes it as a painful privilege, doesn't he? Which is a wonderful phrase. Okay, well, let's talk about systems thinking then. What is it? And perhaps more importantly, what isn't it?
So systems thinking is a pair of two words that can be very, very controversial. I'll be quite honest, 90% of the people that use the words don't really have an understanding of it. That's not their fault. It's not an issue. Systems thinking isn't about systems. It's not about fixing systems. It's not about it's the system, not the people. It's not about customer value. It's not about defining purpose by the organisation. It's got nothing to do with it's the system, not the people. It's simply a way of looking at the world and framing the world. So you're essentially understanding that as I understand the world is based on how I've framed it. How other people understand it is based on how they framed it, and that frame is going to be different to my own. The essential practice is got about 30 underpinning concepts, ideas and principles, and there's probably about 20 various approaches that fit within the wider umbrella. But what that essentially means is that it's different for everyone. It's not the same. And it's different because based on what they choose to apply from those principles, how they choose to apply those principles, and what they choose to apply that to, which makes everyone's systems practice totally different and totally unique to themselves. My personal belief is that the world is inconceivably complex. It's far too complex for us human beings to really make sense of the interdependencies and the interconnections out there that are driving what's happening. But we can allow ourselves to better sense make of it through being quite rigorous around how we frame and how we think about how we've framed. And a really useful way to do that is to think in systems.
I suppose the obvious question that comes to my mind is that if everybody sees a problem a different way and there are numerous different ways to deal with that problem, I suppose even people might not even agree on what the problem is. How can we ever work together to solve it?
The answer is it will never be solved, so don't try. I think you probably recognise, having been a police officer over 20 years, that the amount of energy companies, not just the police, but companies invest in trying to solve things that are unsolvable, if we just didn't do these projects, if we didn't just set off to try and solve things and arrive at this imagined state of almost conveyor belt-like smoothness running, if we didn't have that end goal in mind, we would save so much time by just accepting that's not going to happen, so let's not try and get there. You've got two ways of looking at the world. You could say, right, it's really, really complicated. Essentially what we've got with this problem is it's a really big tight knot in a piece of string, and what we need to do is we need to dive right into it and just start undoing this knot, picking it up, and then we'll have a nice long straight piece of string. And everyone will be happy that the knot's undone and the string's straight. But what you've got is not everyone agrees it's a knot. Not everyone thinks it's a piece of string. And therefore, what you find yourself doing is trying to plait fog. Intangible. You can't touch it. You can't bend it to your will. You can't fix the system. You can just better understand, well, do you think this is a knot? I don't think it's not at all, actually. What I think that is the thing that stops me from letting the dog go further down the lead, because it bang, and then I know roughly that's enough lead that he can't throw himself out into the middle of the road. All right, because I thought it was well, to me, it's not even a rope, do you know what I mean? To me, it's this. And you can apply that to almost every problem you try and solve. The best metaphor I ever read was when the Titanic sank, there was 5,000 lobsters saved. There's a reframing of almost every situation, and it's checking ourselves and making sure, hang on a minute, let's just step outside my current understanding and view on this, and let's just see from what point isn't this a problem.
Okay, well, we've talked quite a bit about concepts there, so perhaps if we could take, an arbitrary everyday example of something and apply systems thinking to it, what should we consider and what surprising things might we find?
The great example is the train analogy. There was a really bad train crash, high-speed train crash. There were people killed in the train crash. Government reaction to that would replicate in how the police react to things would be, let's slow the trains down. Slow the trains down, make trains safer. And it did. What's the likely behaviour that's going to cause people to do if we slow the trains down?
Stop using the trains.
And what are they going to use?
The roads, I guess.
But there's much more people killed in cars than trains, even at the higher level. So we've made trains safer, but if we've pushed up, what are we actually trying to achieve? Another level where we're trying to make people safe. We've actually made people less safe because we were too narrow in the scope of what we were considering when we took direct action, and we made something overall less safe. So there's that really being critical around, are we being too narrow in our consideration here, and is there going to be an unintended consequence, a knock-on effect? You see this in policing a lot in terms of, let's go burglaries. We might have one or two burglaries that go wrong, so then an automatic reaction would be, okay, we are going to now take a statement at every single burglary we attend, and that will make burglaries better. How much resource have you just zapped having people at every single burglary spend an extra hour taking? That is a massive amount of resource that is now not patrolling the streets, not deploying to other incidences. Therefore, you've effectively reduced the capacity of the police force to respond to everything outside of burglary. And in effect, you've potentially made it more dangerous by being too narrow in your scope. So it's always about considering there's only so much capacity. We need to be really critical about what we do and not far too in the detail. We can go in the detail, but we need to step back and consider the wider before we act with a singular targeted thing. It's the individual that applies systems thinking. The thinking isn't applied to the individual. And I've explored a metaphor with one of the leaders we worked with, and he said, it feels like I'm steering a ship, just trying to keep it on course. And my first response to that was, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because a ship is a physical structure, and you can turn it, and you can sort of control it, because you can turn it as a physical structure, whereas an organisation is just a collective of people, and people can't be turned because they just sort of do what they want, because they've got their own intents, their own purposes, their own agendas, and they don't behave like a ship. They can't be turned. They can't be steered. So you can't really observe the system. What you can accept is, what I am observing is my observation. My observation, but I am aware that I've created that observation, and that observation might be wrong. And what I'm also observing, I am influencing. I'm the one that's identifying patterns and connections, and I'm also, depending on how I'm behaving, affecting those patterns and interactions. So for instance, I think you interviewed Chief Constable Andy Rhodes recently. He might go into the force control room or the response office in Charlie Nick, or he might go out with a police officer and sit next to them, and he can observe the system. Do you think the system behaves the same when Chief Constable Andy Rhodes is there as opposed to when Chief Constable Rhodes Andy isn't there? So it makes it very difficult to observe a system.
All right, well, following on from that, I suppose, is that how does well-being fit into the system?
I'm glad you've asked this question. It's about it not fitting into the system. People don't fit into systems. There's a couple of metaphors that systems people will use. It's the system, not the people. fix the system. I would describe that as a mechanical metaphor, which is reducing people to cogs. People don't respond well to being reduced to being cogs. People are people. They're not the system. They don't turn up to spin round in circles. Think about a hospital, for instance. What's the purpose of a hospital? Well, it depends who you are. Mm. There's no purpose to a hospital. It completely depends who you are. If you're the patient and you're unwell, it's probably, I'm really unwell, could you help me? Make me feel a bit better. If you're the doctor that's young and aspiring and wants to be a surgeon, it's probably allowing you to do your practice and provide you a job, but also allowing you to develop as a doctor, try new stuff, develop your skills. Now, if you look at it from a mechanical viewpoint, you could say, well, yeah, that's all great, but we're here to drive value through the organisation, through our processes, and this stuff is non-value-adding activity to the customer journey. So we need you to stop doing that, and let's just reduce everything down to the level of what we need to do, conveyor belt speed. The knock-on effects of that is, well, how does that doctor feel now about working for you? Doesn't feel very engaged, not getting what he wants, potentially going to leave and go work somewhere else. And you're potentially then not going to attract and keep the best doctors, which is then going to have a knock-on effect to the patients because they're not getting the best treatment. And also we're less likely to change the paradigm, the current state, and find that new fix that just changes everything. Yeah, that thing that means all this stuff that was a problem, we now, it isn't a problem anymore. We've cured this type of cancer. We've done this because we experimented. We didn't focus on just meeting the demand as it hits us in its current form with our current capability. Then you've got, outside that, you've probably got your cleaner that comes in 2 hours every morning. Let's say he's a 70-year-old man. His wife's died, comes in every morning, does your 2 hours, mops around, has a chat with the receptionist, wanders in, sticks his head in, has a chat to everyone. What's the purpose of the system to him? It's not to mop the floor. It's probably to have some social connection, a sense of purpose, a sense of enjoyment. But we could say, well, actually, I think you can do that work in 1 hour if you just stop bloody gabbing and just get on and mop the floor. Is he turning back up? No, he's not. And now we've got to try and find someone that's willing to do this work. Are we going to find the same person that fills our staff with joy, that creates that family feel, that means people enjoy being at work and they engage being at work? There's absolutely a balance between all these things that means that you can't just be about having a laugh, you can't just be, but it's about managing everyone's needs. People aren't here to be part of the system. They're here for their own needs, and we need to allow for that, allow organisations to be much more human. And by saying, we've got a system, you miss that.
Well, certainly from a police officer's point of view, then obviously stress at work, the incidents that they attend, all contributes to their stress. But there are other things perhaps to consider, isn't there, such as home life and their social life perhaps.
We don't really do what the Americans do anymore. We don't bring family into our culture. We don't encourage wives and children to be involved in social activities as a police force. We're very insular. We go out on police dues, and that's a really, really easy habit to fall into. I just socialise with police. It becomes more about being the police officer then, because then your social interaction is now governed by the job, and then the job can go, right, you don't work on team 5 Preston anymore, you work on team 3 Scam. And now all of a sudden all your friends and all your social life's gone because they're working at different times in a different area. And these things have huge knock-on consequences for someone's well-being, yet they're outside of the scope of what we traditionally focus on in terms of what does it take for someone to be well. The other view and the other perspective you can take is, okay, so we could spend a lot of time focusing on what we don't want. We don't want trauma. We don't want people to be sad. We don't want people to feel depressed. We've all been there, and we can tackle them, absolutely. But what about if we took the other view and we focused on, well, what do we want? Well, I can drop myself back into that young Bobby, drop myself in my Altbergs, and I could say, well, what do I want? And I know what I want. It wasn't that much, actually. It was, I want to go home on time most of the time. I want to have my dinner. And I want it to feel like my dinner is, and having to sit down and having 10, 15 minutes is prioritised. I want to be able to get time off reasonably easily if I've got family events. I want to feel like it's more than likely that I'm going to be able to get that. I accept that occasionally I won't, but I want to feel like I'm going to be able to get that. They're not big things that I want, just basic stuff. These are what I want. These are all things that have a huge impact on my well-being, long-term, not just short-term. You might turn up in a little bit of a grump, because you missed a christening. But 20 years down the line, for me, even 13 years down the line, and I look back at all the family occasions, I look at all the family pictures that are up on my nana's wall, my dad's wall, and go, I wasn't at that one. And all of a sudden, I don't know about yourself, Dave, but sometimes that can really weigh on you, just when you're sat and you just think, geez.
So what you're basically saying from that is that it's the simple things, isn't it, of just having time to yourself or time to do things that make you happy. And I'm curious as to see how systems thinking versus mindfulness, do they tally?
Yeah, it's a really interesting observation. We know there's things that make them unhappy, but we know there's some really basic stuff that isn't beanbags. It's not sleep pods. It's not even going out on work's dues. It's some properly basic human stuff that can make people happy. But how have we ended up where that's not there anymore? And it goes back to what the theme of the conversation. It's about we've thought too much about an organisation as a system. And by doing so, we've tried to optimise the system. Look at how we've designed our shift patterns, our overlaps. It's all based around optimization, as if you're managing a mechanical system. In a purposeful activity scenario, the maximum efficiency you're going to get out of people over an extended period of time, maximum, the rule of thumb, 67%. Do we think our shift patterns are designed for that? No. So is there any wonder that we're not getting our dinner? And it doesn't feel, I remember being told, but it's a grade two. There's no immediate threat for life. All it is an arbitrary target that's got no meaning to this. But you've said that that's a priority over me having my dinner. And that's going to be a priority for me for as long as I work on the front line, giving parts of myself to society. I don't think that's reasonable. And it's all part of how we've designed a organisation as a system and tried to optimise it, as opposed to allowing for what we've actually got is a social community of people coming to work and interacting with each other, and these people need time.
So I suppose rather than addressing the symptoms of stress through systems thinking, what we really need is some sort of mental vaccine to it.
Absolutely. We need to think about everything that's involved in being wellbeing, not thinking that we can isolate it to getting rid of the bad stuff in someone's work. It's a level of how well someone feels is, it's never going to be stable, and there's a lot involved there, but there's lots of stuff we could give back just by making our organisations more human. And by doing that, we need to start thinking about them as human and not thinking about them as systems.
Well, that very nicely brings us on to, do organisations place unrealistic targets on those it employs? And if so, who are to blame within the organisation? The person at the top, maybe, or does the message at some point get lost further down?
Targets is, there's a great story going back to the Soviet Union. There's so many lessons to be learned by comparing the Soviet Union to how police forces work. They worked via sort of an approach to a system, not a people. It was everyone works to the greater good, the purpose that's defined extrinsically from people. And they set factories targets, and the target for nail creation was the weight of nails. The total weight of nails was how they were targeted. And the country had a significant shortage of small nails because they were pumping out huge, massive nails. And then they went, okay, well, this has obviously gone wrong. What we're going to do is we're going to set them a target on how many nails they create. And then they had a shortage of big nails. Targets drive behaviour. It's very rarely good behaviour. Targets are finite, not infinite. We are always going to have to work with targets. But when I say targets, I mean ones that we can't not have. For instance, your budget. That's a target. The target is you've got to do whatever you do within your budget. That's a fact of life. And we all know that if that target didn't exist, we could deliver really, really good policing. But we can't. So why do we then impose targets that we could not have, that we know are going to drive adverse behaviour? So the most bonkers one is they've got a target to reduce crime. Well, I'll tell you what, if you make me Prime Minister now, I could get rid of crime 100% tomorrow and just reclassify it all and get rid of crime. It doesn't exist. It's paper exercise. The purpose of policing is not to reduce crime, to detect crime. It's a nonsense. We made up what is and isn't detected. The government make up what is and isn't a crime. And guess what? The world is far more complex than that and really doesn't care about our definitions. What are we trying to do? Let's think about it differently. So when you think about targets, you end up at, remember when we talked about what, why, how? You dive right into the how, don't you? Right into the activity. I just want to see lots of activity. I want to see lots of detections. I want to see lots of this. We don't really care about what's being achieved. What are we trying to do? Well, we're not, the purpose of policing isn't to keep people safe. That's impossible. That can't be the purpose of policing. It's utter rubbish. What is required for a person to be safe is so much wider than policing. It's very, very silly, unrealistic and unpragmatic to suggest that that's what policing's about. What policing might be about is to take action to encourage society to behave more culturally acceptable, that makes it safer for the whole. So people as a collective are safer overall and feel safer. That might be a goal. And then we need to think about, okay, well, what would be useful information we would need to let us know if society was starting to feel safer, and what would be a useful, acceptable time delay on that, in terms of to say, okay, we feel like that's had a change. So early action is a great example for that. If we're going to take early action, how long do we think realistically it would be until we saw a difference? And not only that, what would that difference look like? Because you can't say crime levels, because we change what is and isn't crime frequently. So the environment changes and there's much more things going. So you could be going, right, we're going to do this. And you do some great work, you change some minds. And then all of a sudden Brexit comes along and there's loads of crime because of Brexit. Absolutely nothing to do about the great work you've done, and could have potentially been much worse without your investment. But you would never know, because we're not living in a sliding door situation. You don't get to go back and replay. So what information do you want to see? What do you want to understand? And then when you've had that, okay, well, has that contributed towards society as a whole? Is it making things better? If the answer's yes, fantastic. If the answer's actually, you know what, it's not worked out as we hope, well, fantastic, and well done for acknowledging that and learning, and what's the next thing we do. Targets don't do that. Targets don't learn. Targets don't sit anywhere near what, and what links why to how. And targets drive people to self-organise in ineffective, inappropriate ways.
I like these old sayings, and one of them is damn lies and statistics, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one that really bothers me about all these selfish people is that, did you know that if every time you're buying ice cream that you're putting someone at risk of being killed by a shark? The more ice cream that is bought, the more shark attacks happen. It's statistically proven. Ice cream sales go up, shark attacks go up. Absolute fact. Yet you going out selfishly, imagine, just eating ice cream whenever you fancy, there's people out there dying. Statistics lie. It's utter rubbish. It's such a reduced version of reality. Shark attacks go up when it gets hotter, because when it's hotter, people go to the beach and swim in the sea. Also, when it's hotter, people buy ice cream. There's sort of two links. So what we can't say is crime's gone down, people are safer. Really? What environment's changed around for crime to go down? Oh, we reclassified this. Oh, we set a target to reduce crime. Oh, so what's happening is now bobbies are potentially just going around and, oh, maybe that's not that, maybe it's this, or maybe it's not that, or they're getting a phone call going, you think that's a criminal damage? Looks like it might be interference to me, and you know that's not recordable, so essentially crime's gone down, and we've got a target to get crime down 10%. Is that the society we want to be in? Do we want to live by statistics, or do we want to live by more human stuff? How are we talking to our communities? How are we engaging with them? How do they feel? Let's not assume all information needs to live in stats.
So finally, Liam, clearly a complex topic, just seems to be an endless flowchart of endless possibilities. It's enough to drive you mad. But if there is one thing that perhaps we could take away from this podcast today and apply to our own lives, what would that be?
If there's one thing people would take, we've already touched on it. If you are in the police, go and pick the book up, go and read. I've got nothing to do with it, I get no benefit from it. It was a real part of changing my life, an emotional survival guide for law enforcement officers, and read it. Not when everything's gone wrong, but right now. Right at the start of your police career, read it, keep it, and keep rereading it, and apply it to practice. And the moment you think you forgot about it, go and pick it up again. Stop being a police officer, start working as a police officer. Keep control of some of your life, keep control of your social life. just keep as much of yourself to yourself. Don't give it all to the job. You give enough. You give enough to society. Make sure you keep enough of yourself to keep yourself well.
It's been a fascinating chat. It really has. I mean, there's a lot to take in, but when you do get down and start to really think about it, it does challenge basically everything that you believe and the way you see things, I suppose.
I hope so. I hope people have found this interesting. I hope you've found things that you can relate to in terms of my journey, and the hope that I've put some concepts across that people can potentially find useful and can go out there and put into practice, because that's what it's about. It's about giving people stuff that's useful that allows them to understand their world and interact with it.
Well, thank you for your time today. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave. It's been a pleasure.